Well, Richard Garriott wasn't the first member of his family to go into space. His father, Owen Garriott, flew to space twice. This gives Richard a special distinction. He's the first American to be a second-generation astronaut. Richard Garriott made his fortune in video games, and he's in town today to give a lecture at the Linda Hall Library. More on that event in just a few minutes. And Richard Garriott, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Steve. It's great to be with you today.
Well, there are so many things I want to ask you about. You're an adventurer. You've done things that I've only dreamed of doing one day. One of them was dropping down to the bottom of the Atlantic to see the Titanic. Tell us about seeing that wreckage for the first time.
That's obviously an amazing experience in oh so many ways. You know, just the submarine operations to take these twin 25-ton vehicles on a four-hour journey to the bottom of the sea is
4 hours to get
4 hours
down there.
of just dropping like a rock to get to the bottom. But then, when you arrive on the seafloor near the Titanic, you usually don't want to drop right on top of the Titanic.
So
you,
not be you, a good idea.
You land nearby, and as you kind of go along the seafloor, the first thing you begin to see is all the debris scattered across the seafloor from when the Titanic ripped in half and then dumped out onto the seafloor.
It's still there all these years later.
Oh, yeah. Well, by the way, it won't be for that many more decades because it's slowly rusting away.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of things that won't rust away, like the porcelain dishes and the pieces of furniture and tables and chairs and luggage, anything that people had with them on board.
What did you think when you saw that? What's that like when you come across something like that? You obviously had a big fascination with it.
Yeah, of course, of course. And when you come upon it at this depth, it's so dark. And despite the water is relatively clear, but still water compared to air is blocks light pretty efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these big light booms out that are shining as brightly as you can to see only 20 or 30 feet in front of you. So it's almost like you emerge out of the darkness to discover this monumental item, the Titanic itself, sitting on the seafloor just as it sank. So the place where it was ripped apart, you can see literally metal sheared apart. You can go look into each deck. The scenes, the movie Titanic was actually filmed with these exact same submarines. In fact, James Cameron, I'm one of the co-owners of the company Deep Ocean Expeditions that charters these, and James chartered them through Deep Ocean Expeditions to film the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything you saw in the movie is pretty much exactly the way I saw it as well at the same time.
The light comes from where? What's the source of the light?
Well, no light comes from the surface.
Of course.
Far too deep. But the submarines themselves have booms that it can swing out on either side that are probably 10 feet long. And each of those booms has a whole grid of lights on it so that you mm-hmm. can provide light to whatever it is you want to look at in front
yeah.
of you.
And we had Robert Ballard on this show a few years ago talking about, he was the first man to discover the Titanic again back in 1985. And when he was talking to me, one image that has stayed with me ever since, all these years later, is this notion that what surprised him when he first came across it were all the shoes, leather shoes that still sit on the floor of the ocean. I was fascinated by that. And he said they're still there because the tannin in the leather was resistant to corrosion from the salt water. Just an amazing idea to me.
No, I quite agree. And in fact, this debris field, which in many ways is the most interesting thing to explore, has this combination of, there's large amounts of coal on the seafloor that we obviously used to power the screws, the motors that mm-hmm. kept this thing moving. But in other areas, what you really see is the personal effects of all the people who are on board. And so it's sort of like people's lives just sort of laid out across the seafloor that really drives home, this is not just some inanimate object. This mm-hmm. is, there were, thousands of people on board, many of whom did not make it. And their personal effects are laid right out here in front of you.
So what was it like for you personally to come across this scene? I mean, was it breathtaking? Were you shocked? What was it like?
Well, what's interesting is some of the folks who went with us, found it to be a very emotional scene in the sense of because of its the tragedy of its history.
Yeah.
For me personally, I was while of course I reflected on that tragedy, I was more impressed with just the awe and surrealness of the visuals themselves.
I'm sure.
There was a scene that's also in the movie where, you know, we could take these subs and settle right down inside the grand staircase because the dome of it had gone away. And you could look down the hallways and you could see the light fixtures kind of barely hanging by a cord.
Okay.
So, you know, and they weren't really swinging. It was pretty steady, but you could imagine them sort of gently swaying if the ship was at sea. And so it's sort of this frozen, this kind of Victorian scene, frozen in time, that's been, you know, sitting still, slowly decaying on the bottom of the seafloor for 100 years. And so it's an awesome experience.
You're on the floor. You're around the Titanic for how long when you do something like
this? We were down on the seafloor for almost 10 hours because you're going to stay down as long as you can because it, you know, took you 4 hours to get there.
Yeah.
You know, make the most of
it. You're coming back the next day. Yeah.
Exactly. You're making one trip and one trip only. So you know, and it's about a 4 hour trip back up. So you launch, you know, at sunrise and you surface and pull back onto the deck of the ship after dark. So it's a full day trip.
You know, somewhere else you've been, Richard, that just again grabbed my attention was the Antarctica, which you describe as the most beautiful place you've ever been to. And that struck me too, because I don't think of Antarctica necessarily as beautiful. Why?
You know, it does seem counterproductive. You know, the interior of Antarctica has only two things: ice and rock, plus whatever you brought with you. Nothing else.
Right.
But Antarctica, the grandeur of Antarctica, and the way the laws of physics seem to completely change is profound. You know, just looking at a scene, if we go look out the window here, you know, you can tell things are near or far away based upon a lot of clues. You know, the scale of a building or a tree, haze in the air. In Antarctica, when there's just little ripples in the snow that become moguls in the snow, that become deep undulations in the snow, you can't tell something that's small and nearby to something that's large and far away. And also the air is perfectly clear, so there's no gray haze.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're constantly impressed by how alien it feels. And one of my most memorable moments was seeing what looked to be the wind off a mountain had scoured a, you know, few hundred meter tall and miles long, what appeared to be a frozen tidal wave. And we would walk along the base of it thinking you're in like a Tim Burton movie with the wave about to crash down on you and snow dripping off the edges. And you looked into the ice and you could imagine seeing like a frozen whale or a dinosaur or something in the ice, which of course was never there. But that's how you felt, is you were in this completely alien, overwhelming environment.
You wanted to go there. Why?
Well, we were there to go on meteorite hunting expeditions.
Tell our listeners about why meteorites.
Well, so meteorites actually fall all over the Earth all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, lots of people have seen shooting stars at night, and those are little meteorites, you know, coming down. The roof of everybody's house has meteorites land on it, but they're about the size of a grain of rice.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't find them around most parts of the Earth because they get buried in the grass or rain dissolves them away. But in deserts, and in particular ice deserts, so in Antarctica, when they fall on the ice, they stay on the surface. And so if you walk around in Antarctica, it's actually relatively easy to find them. On our second trip, we found 40 over a period of just a few days. On my first trip there, we actually found zero. And that's because we hadn't gone quite far enough south, and the sun warming the rocks sitting on top of the ice made them melt and sink down into the ice. So we may have been near some, but there were no rocks of any kind on the surface of the ice.
Yeah.
We had to go further south for the second trip, where it was even colder, and then we found them quite easily.
You know, game inventor, explorer, adventurer Richard Garriott is my guest. He'll be presenting From the Beginning of Computer Games to Private Space Flight at 7 o'clock tonight at the Linda Hall Library. The event is free and open to the public, but e-tickets are required. We'll put a link on our website for those tickets. That's tonight at 7 at the Linda Hall Library here in town. You know, your dad was an astronaut. He went into space twice, Richard, and clearly that had an enormous influence on you. What was it like to have a father who was an astronaut?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Everyone thinks of their own circumstance as normal. And in my case, my father was an astronaut. My right-hand neighbor was Joe Engel, another astronaut. Left-hand neighbor, Hoot Gibson, another astronaut. Over the back fence, within two or three blocks was most all or a good chunk of the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts my neighbors.
So all dads were astronauts.
Dads were either astronauts or people involved in putting people into space.
Yeah.
And so I just grew up being, you didn't have to decide to be an astronaut. Everyone's going. up until one of the NASA doctors told me that because I needed glasses, I was no longer eligible to be a NASA astronaut. And that was like being kicked out of the club that everyone I knew was sort of a de facto member of.
So big disappointment.
It was huge. And before that, I would have never said, when I grew up, I'm going to go to space. I didn't think you had to. And but after that, I said, well, who are you to be the gatekeeper space doctor? If I can't go by your rules, I'm going to have to invent my own space agency.
Which is what you ended up doing.
That's exactly what I did.
And you went up when?
So I flew in October of 2008, and I flew on a Russian Soyuz. That was arranged by a company that I'm a co-founder of called Space Adventures, and we've flown 7 private citizens to go live aboard the International Space Station.
You were the 6th, do I understand?
I'm the 6th. I was originally scheduled to be the 1st.
I was going to say, what's the deal? It's your company.
It's my company. I actually paid for all the studies to pull off being able to do this at all. But our first opportunity to fly came in 2001, which was right after the dot-com crash. And I'm a computer game maker. And so all of my net worth was tied up in dot-com businesses. And so I actually had to sell the seat that I had arranged for myself.
Oh, you're kidding.
To a guy named Dennis Tito, who became the first private citizen to fly.
How disappointing was that?
Hugely.
Yeah.
Hugely. And in fact, I basically was wiped out, as so many were at that time. So I then had to go build another company, sold another company. And then as soon as I had the money, I said, okay, I'm not going to let this slip through my fingers again. So first thing I did when I knew I could afford it is spent the majority of my net worth to go fly.
The majority of your net worth? Because it was just something you felt like from the time you were a little kid, you were going to do someday.
Absolutely. So I've been obviously very devoted to this. I've been, even though, I've earned a very good living, obviously, in computer games, all of the personal investing I've done, I've had financial planners do some investing for me on the side, but anything I've personally elected to put money into has been towards the commercialization of access to space.
And was going up everything you hoped it was going to be?
Oh, yes, of course. And I would actually also say not only was it a great joy for me personally, I would argue that the group of us that started the XPRIZE, which was a $10 million prize to bring private space vehicles into existence, Space Adventures, Zero G Corp that does parabolic flights to take people on Zero G experiences. That effort is really what has turned even the government from doing purely internal rocket development into doing commercial space development. So I would even argue that SpaceX, the existence of SpaceX, the existence of Blue Origin, the existence of Virgin Galactic for sure, all really this whole new wave of commercial access, which is decreasing the cost for all users, including NASA, democratizing access to private individuals and corporations, this new renaissance of activity like people trying to do asteroid mining, that all really is an outgrowth of this effort of myself and, half a dozen other people that kicked this off in the late 90s.
Given your long-standing interest to finally get into space in 2008, you read a book like The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe, and you come away with the impression that guys like John Glenn go into space, and when they're taking off and going into space, their heartbeat never changes. They're just as calm, as cool as cucumbers. And I'm wondering, given how long you wanted to get up there, what was takeoff, liftoff like for you, and how fast was your heart beating when you finally got there, Richard?
It's fascinating because I would actually say anybody that gets through this sort, whether you apply to be an astronaut or you have an equally difficult time, I would argue, to get through it the way I did. You take this very seriously. You're also very well trained. You're very well prepared for this.
I was going
to
ask.
I trained for 2 years in Russia and had to go through major surgery to correct some potential issues that would have otherwise happened in orbit or could have happened in orbit.
You trained for 2 years to go into. So this isn't like hopping on the Greyhound and going up to Des Moines. This is something altogether different.
Oh, yeah. No, in fact, every person who flies, on an airplane, there's the cockpit for the pilots and, passengers sit in the back. Well, there's no such thing on a Soyuz rocket that I went on. There's the commander sits in the center seat, and he has most of the command and control activities. The flight engineer sits in the left seat. They program all the computers and fly the rocket. And I'm in the scientist seat on the right side. But my job's included things like I'm the first one in the spaceship. I turn it on. That's kind of a fun first job.
Really?
I bring on all the power. I manage all the power buses. I manage all the life support, both to the interior cabin of the vehicle itself, but also to the suits, the survival suits, the pressure suits we are wearing. I manage all of that as well. And so there's stuff that, you know, I better do or we're not going anywhere and likely people will die. And also, you have to train on every system because in case somebody else is incapacitated, you want to make sure that, you know, you can survive the trip home on your own if you need to.
I didn't have any sense that it was this involved.
Yeah, well, that's why 2 years is the kind of minimum requirement. It's really over a period of 2 years. We've now found ways to compress that even tighter. But for me anyway, it was about 2 years. So when launch actually comes, as you're asking,
you dodged my question so far.
So So when launch comes, what's interesting is, when you get in the rocket, if the day you board is of course. Incredibly emotionally overwhelming. It's the first time you've ever stood next to a fully fueled, ready to launch rocket and had to ride up the elevator in this rickety gantry. Well, there's, the thing's full of cryogenic fuel, so there's ice on the outside and any air coming near it is streaming. This fog is just streaming down the sides of it.
Yeah, I can.
And you can hear
that,
the pumps, whirring and popping and gas venting. And so it's awesome to just board it. But what's interesting is once you get on board, you settled in, you do your configuration details, and then there's a couple hours of waiting.
Were you able to function? Were you so overwhelmed that you were having to slow down somehow?
No. Actually, once you crack open the books,
you're rolling.
In it. You've rehearsed this a million times. And so once you crack open the books, you just go through it, and you have an excitement, this underlying excitement, of course. But then you get to this hold. That in all the simulated trials you do, you don't bother sitting there doing nothing for an hour or two. You just skip it. And the first day ever you can't skip it is launch day.
Huh.
And so you get to this time where you stop and you start talking to your crewmates and go like, oh, wow, I guess we have nothing to do for a while. And you talk about your friends and family who are just a kilometer out there probably biting their fingernails, wondering if this is going to blow up or take off or not go.
Were you worried about that?
Statistically, it's extreme. On the Soyuz, it's extremely safe. The one thing, if you were claustrophobic at all, you would not like the cramped quarters on a Soyuz.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I started getting in the final constructed rocket full of safety gear packed in tight, you also intellectually sit back and think about it. If this goes badly wrong and the whole thing falls over and catches on fire, you are not getting out. I mean, it's just a fact. You're just not getting out.
Wow.
But you sort of think that through and you go like, well, sure hope things don't go that badly.
Right.
But then you sort of set it aside and you just go like, here we go. But the launch, the thing that's interesting about launch is that, if you stand on the outside or see one on television, it's loud, it's thunderous, there's vibration.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get to that line item on your flight data file that says the engines have lit or the engines are lighting, you expect to feel some rumble and hear some rumble. But you don't. It's
really?
Almost perfectly silent and perfectly smooth. When you get to the line where the vehicle begins to rise to lift off, you expect it to be like dropping the clutch on a sports car. But in fact, it's only when the thrust has become slightly greater than the mass of the vehicle. And so the acceleration is almost it's just slightly above zero.
Mm-hmm.
And so you actually don't feel that transition from being still to moving. All you feel is that gravity begins to slightly increase. And get heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier.
And breathing becomes harder.
And
maybe?
Breathing becomes more and more labored. But you've also simulated that, through a centrifuge. So that's not surprising. But even the centrifuge is more rattly and herky-jerky than the real flight. It's almost perfectly smooth, almost perfectly quiet. It feels more
must
like
be an
a,
incredible feeling.
It's like a confident ballet move lifting you ever faster into the sky. It's very serene. It's very beautiful. There is part of your mind where you're waiting, so if something does go wrong, what will happen at this phase is the escape tower will jettison. And if that were to happen, you're going to get a kick in the pants that is pretty severe that's going to knock the wind out of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's part of you that's kind of going like, well, no kick in the pants yet. Let's keep going. No kick in the pants yet. Let's keep going.
Are you talking to your fellow flyers at this point, or is it just
no,
quiet?
We're doing checklists. At this point, checklists is pretty much full time.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been through the checklist many times, too. And so you have enough time to be aware of subtle things like they have some cameras on the inside. And mission control on the ground, it's actually prescribed which camera will be on at different times. And so I, for example, because I'm a gamer and I took some stuff up for my games, on the back page where I knew the camera would be on me, I put a message written in the secret writing of my games on the back of my flight data file so I could hold it up to the camera and make a little signal back to the gamers who would be following me along.
So was your heart racing?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I actually haven't looked to compare. It didn't feel like it. I didn't actually measure to see if it was considerably higher.
Yeah. Again, we're talking to Richard Garriott here. If you want to join our conversation, what a very good conversation it is. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So you were up there for how long?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
So That's a long time.
Yeah, spent just over 24 hours on board the Soyuz that I launched on. So I spent one night sleeping on the Soyuz.
Until you joined the space station.
Until we docked to the space station, mm-hmm. and then 12 days on the space station.
Tell me about the docking. What was that like?
Well, you know, what's interesting about reaching space is people don't realize how fast you get there. You know, if you think about climbing on an airplane to altitude where they can turn off the seatbelt sign, you know, that's 10 or 15 minutes at least, maybe a little longer. When you launch off the ground to reach orbit and be close to the space station, the engines burn merely for 8.5 minutes.
Huh.
So you go from 0 miles an hour to 17,210 miles an hour in 8.5 minutes. And when that just
stops me.
Yeah, and when the
did you feel like you're going? Is there any sense of that kind of speed when you're going?
You know, in fact, even though I'm sitting right next to a window, there's a fairing on it during the initial part of launch, and by the time the fairing is removed, a covering, a sort of a not plastic, but you know, you can imagine it as a molded sheet that mm-hmm. goes around the whole vehicle so that it's slippery like an airplane shape.
Okay.
Once you're in space and there's no air, you don't need to be you don't need to worry about what the shape is. So the fairing goes away, and now you have a more blobby shaped vehicle that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And the first view I got of the Earth, well before docking, was right after the engines cut off. You know, you tumble over and you look back at the Earth, and you would expect at this moment, I'm finally, you know, I spent 35 years trying to reach space. You know, eureka, I've made it.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
You expect to look out the window and go, oh, look how beautiful the Earth is down below me. And for many people, I think that's exactly what the reaction is. I have to confess that my reaction was a little different. Mine, when I look back at the Earth, my first thought was, wow, we're not nearly as high up as I thought we were going to be. I sure hope we're in a perfectly circular orbit, or we're going to be re-entering again in just a couple of minutes,
really?
And that will be bad.
Because it was filling up the whole window screen?
Yeah, well, also, you know, you can mentally do this calculation, which I had done ahead, but until you see it, or see pictures, you know, if you think about how high an airplane flies at, 10 or 20 miles up, or you look at the clouds, you know, at similar height. Well, the space station is only at 250 miles up, so we're only talking 10 or 20 times higher than an airplane.
Hmm.
And that is, you know, it's not like you're on the moon. It's not like when you look back from the moon, you see the tiny blue
this
marble
little thing.
Over there.
Yeah, right.
When you look down, it actually is surprisingly familiar. The detail you can see is surprisingly sharp. Like when you travel over, say, San Francisco, you can easily see the Golden Gate Bridge, the Oakland Bay Bridge, Alcatraz, the V-shaped wakes of ships going in and
right?
out.
Right. I guess I didn't have a sense of that either. That's amazing to me.
Yeah, and so you feel very intimate, but you also are traveling 17,000 miles an hour, which means you go all the way around the Earth in 90 minutes. It means you see a sunrise or sunset every 45 minutes. That means you cross entire continents like the United States or North America in 20 minutes. And so you're just glued to the window because it is like there is this fire hose of information about the Earth that is just pouring into your mind just by looking. And so you see how cloud formations how clouds form and move. You can see the results of tectonic plate movement, erosion by water, erosion by wind, the impact of humanity with roads everywhere, dams everywhere, farms everywhere, how fires, forest fires in one place will, you know, we went over Nevada and you could see a single point fire, which is probably a big fire on the ground, but it would fill the air column all the way up to the top of the sky and covering a state or two with yellow sickly smog. And so you're just glued to this, just going like, my understanding of how the large-scale systems of the Earth work is going up rapidly just by watching.
Wow. And philosophically, are you thinking great thoughts?
Well, what's interesting
is a symphony playing in your head, Richard? Or
well, what's interesting is there's something that the I'm not sure if it's the majority, but many space travelers, including myself, have happened to them.
Yeah.
That is classically referred to as the overview effect. And what that is after they go through the epiphanies that I just mentioned to you, and we almost all have that exact same list of under this fire hose of information that's going into your brain.
Right.
And after you've been around the Earth, you know, dozens or hundreds of times, you then see an area that you know well. And so in my case, it was when I flew back over Texas, where I grew up. I've, you know, driven it a lot. I've bicycled a lot. I've camped in it. You know, I've jogged to, you know, run some reasonable distances across it. And at the same time, you can see the whole Earth that you've now been around 100 times. So you sort of, you've mapped that in your brain. Suddenly you go, I now know the true scale of the Earth by direct observation. And it's like in the movies where you have this physical reaction that feels like in the movies where they might zoom a lens in but dolly the camera backwards, mm-hmm. to where the actor, the main scene of the actor, doesn't change size, but the hallway or reality around them collapses.
Mm-hmm.
And you have that same thing. I mean, I still get goosebumps telling that story, but you have this literally physical shudder when you kind of make this realization of how you now understand or you're connected to the Earth in a way you never were before. And lots of astronauts describe that same event.
Yeah.
I had never even heard that word prior to my flight. I just, having had that reaction, I went, okay, this I can't be that unique. This has got to be a pretty common response. And I looked it up afterwards.
That's right. There's a phenomenon that goes attached with that then.
Yeah.
So the weightlessness thing, how was that?
So weightlessness is really one of the best. You know, the view is probably the number one reason to be in space if you're just from an enjoyment standpoint.
Yeah.
A close second is living in a weightless environment 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with the exception of the first few days when you arrive, and the first few days after you get back. For a substantial number of people, probably the majority of people, get some form of motion sickness or some kind of discomfort, So what's interesting about how and why that happens is sort of an interesting experiment to do on yourself when you're flying also, which is, you know, here on Earth, you know, your inner ear has a function that helps you determine that gravity is downwards. But in space, of course, there's no downwards. So the fluid in your inner ear doesn't naturally go anywhere. But if I were to move my face forwards towards you, the fluid in my ear would go toward the back, which would make me feel like I'm falling backwards.
Oh, wow.
And so what you see and what your body feels are actually different. They're disconnected. You get a misperception.
Is that cool? Or
no,
scary?
That's actually, no, it's not. It's what makes people sick. It's you know, it's seen to be something similar as getting seasick on a boat, or if you read a book in the back of a car while driving, how that can be provocative to some people for motion sickness. And after 3 days, your brain just sort of rewires it and goes, oh, I don't have a gravity detector. I have an accelerometer in my head. And then when you get back to Earth, you have the reverse problem.
Oh, wow.
Now you have an accelerometer in your head. And so when you like lie on your pillow at night to try to sleep, it feels like you're falling forwards. And so if you close your eyes, you feel like you're tumbling and tumbling and tumbling, sort of like you're having a, you know, hangover or something.
And you countered that how?
Time.
That's all you did.
You just wait for 3 days. It'll go away.
Or can I ask, how much did you spend for this privilege of going into space?
Yeah, so I went, it was about $30 million. The price tag today is actually higher. It's about $55
million. $30
million. And but since I'm also the person who created this company, and of course I was very motivated to go. But I also was equally motivated.
You got a 10% discount.
Well, no. Sadly, the majority of the money that we take in goes immediately to the Russians. So, I couldn't give myself much of a discount. But I was also very motivated, though, to do a lot of work on orbit to not only pay for my own flight, but also to try to find businesses that could open the door for more of us to fly, or so I can go again, since I already mentioned I spent the majority of my net worth to go the first time.
Yeah.
And so I worked very hard to find work to do that was somewhere in related value to the high cost of flying. And I didn't break even, but I did earn some millions of dollars back. Huh. And the importance of that is that the cost of going to space, you might have heard like SpaceX is trying to reuse their vehicle now. They're landing their first stage.
Right.
SpaceX believes they can get the price, their current price per person, if they were flying people, would probably be about $20 million a seat. But then they can get down to, you know, Elon thinks he can get it down to arguably under $1 million. But if it's down to $1 or $2 million, I can make a profit. Huh. And so the way it's headed, I actually think I will get a chance to go again, not because I have a bunch of money in my pocket, but because I'm a good enough entrepreneur to find work to do in space that will more than cover the ticket cost.
And people will wonder, Richard, what was the $30 million worth it for the 2 weeks you were up?
And I would argue, absolutely. I mean, that's literally what I was earning the money for. Mm-hmm. And so when people, I've had people argue like, yeah, you should have, you know, give it the money to the poor. You know, there's a variety of things you could do with this kind of money that would have other purposes. And my counterarguments are twofold. One is, at a personal level, I should be free to pursue whatever routes I wish.
It's my own business.
But I would also argue that I have helped make profound changes in access to space, including cost and viability, and the value that we bring for humanity has been dramatically improved through both my own efforts and the efforts of friends and coworkers.
Let me go to some phone calls here. Lauren from Kansas City, Kansas. Lauren, you're on with Richard DeGarriac. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't know if the guest can answer this, host Steve. However, I'm not sure if he's familiar with the Arctic landscape. However, in that wonderful trip, did he see any evidence of climate change, the melting of the glaciers in the Arctic?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And the short answer is, for the area that I was, no, at least on the Antarctic. What we staged in southern Chile en route to the interior of Antarctica, on the interior, the ice sheet is about a mile thick. And so even if there had been any reduction there, which I think there was not actually, but even if there had been, we probably wouldn't have been able to see it. However, in southern Chile, the recession of the glaciers in southern Chile have been dramatic, and you can even see that evidence, not only from a time-lapse standpoint, but you can observe the lack of vegetation that's grown in the recently receded areas. You can tell that it has been receding even with a single viewing, much less over time. And so so there are areas you can go to both in Antarctica and around to demonstrate that, but I did not see some on my particular trip while I was in Antarctica.
I should point out again that Richard DeGarriac presents From the Beginning of Computer Games to Private Space Flight at 7 tonight at the Linda Hall Library. The event is free. It's open to the public. E-tickets are required. We'll put a link on our website for those tickets. That's tonight at 7 o'clock to see Richard DeGarriac. And Richard, in the radio biz, we call you a terrific guest. You were